Dr. Peter Ree is a trauma surgeon who's treated patients in the combat zones of Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as in inner-city battle zones in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. On January 8, 2011, he was called into Tucson University Medical Center as 10 gunshot victims were being rushed to the hospital after a man opened fire on a crowd of people in front of a local supermarket. One of those victims was Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Dr. Ree has written a new book with the help of Gordon Dillow called Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities, which is about his exhilarating, heartbreaking, challenging, and almost always bloody line of work. I spoke with him in June, and we are rebroadcasting the conversation for you today. I began our conversation by asking, what does the code Trauma Red mean?
So we categorize people who have been hurt into three levels, and trauma centers in the country do very similar coding systems, whether they call it different levels or colors. But red would be about 15% of our patient population in trauma, and they're the most severely injured. And for those, there's a requirement for who has to be in the room present when the patient arrives.
I mean, what doctors and how many nurses have to be there?
Right. And so the highest level of activation, as they call it, requires that a trauma surgeon be in the room when the patient arrives. There will be approximately about four or five other physicians. There'll be an emergency medicine physician in there as well as two nurses and then laboratory technicians.
Can we assume that there'll always be a trauma surgeon available?
Well, it depends on where you get hurt. Not everybody gets to go to trauma centers. And so in the United States, I think it's fairly ubiquitous everywhere. And in major cities, you have a pretty good chance that you'll be taken directly to a trauma center.
Your father was a trauma surgeon.
Well, he was a general surgeon. And back then, general surgeons did trauma when it came to them. But it wasn't a specialty. And that was one of the major reasons why I wrote the book, because our specialty is relatively new. The estimation is maybe 200 to 300 million people know what a brain surgeon is and a heart surgeon is. But I would say the normal person that has no idea what a trauma surgeon is.
You're from Korea, but you wound up living in Uganda when you were a kid.
Right. That was kind of odd. And, you know, I didn't know what was going on when I packed up my things and got on the plane. But that my father chose to go to Uganda. There was a call for physicians from Uganda to our country. About, I think, 10 or 15 families went to Uganda who were in the same situation that we were, and we did a Peace Corps type of mission.
You tell a story in the book about seeing a man with a spear through his belly that your father treated, and that led you to never want to be a trauma surgeon.
I don't, you know, it seems when I go back, I don't know what I was thinking when I saw it, but I remember seeing that man who was considered wealthy because he owned cattle. And he had a spear in his hand, and he was robbed of his cattle. And the officials brought him to our house and to show the patient to my dad instead of my father being at the hospital waiting for him. So that's, you know, how it is when you don't have the kind of resources that we have here. They had to actually bring the patient to my father.
And what struck you most about seeing that man with the spear?
I think what I remember clearly was they actually made him try to get out of the ambulance or the vehicle to show my father instead of my father climbing in to see it. I remember him standing with a spear through his body. I remember the blood, the color of the blood was almost pink against his contrasting skin. And I think those colors are very vivid in my mind.
And yet you changed your mind and you decided to become a doctor.
Well, you know, I grew up learning that the last thing I wanted to do was be a doctor or a lawyer, because as you can imagine, the stereotyping of the Asian families where everybody's pushing you towards those types of profession, and I was just rebelling. So when I went to college, with one career goal in mind, and that was not to be a doctor.
And what did you want to do instead?
I didn't know what was available, so I went into aerospace engineering, and that was the very first checkbox under engineering was the A category, and that was aerospace.
You didn't stay in Uganda. Did Idi Amin throw your family out?
He did. You know, when he came in, what I was expecting from Africa was to see a lot of Africans, but what I saw on a daily basis were mostly Indians because they were the middle class for the British colonies. And I think it was now, in retrospect, what I understand is that Idi Amin wanted the middle class business, and the way he did that was to throw all the Asians out, which included, I think, us. And I don't think he meant to do that, but that was part of the consequence.
Did you go to, when you wound up going to medical school, did you go with the idea of becoming a trauma surgeon? Was that going to be your specialty?
Oh, medical school. When I went to medical school, I wanted to be anything but a surgeon, because everybody knew the hours and the difficulty and the difference in pay. So, you know, I tried desperately to become an anesthesiologist or a radiologist.
And, what happened?
You know, I think you just gravitate towards things that you're good at and where you're accepted.
This is an area which can be very exhilarating in a way, a lot of adrenaline, but also heartbreaking.
You know, I think over the time period, you learn how to put some shell around your heart. And it also requires a fair amount of concentration. You really have to think about what I have to do right now. And without that critical thinking, people die immediately before you.
So empathy is not something that you can allow to take over.
Well,
you have to just think about the job at hand.
You have to do both. I mean, I think in the beginning part of the career, my profession allowed you, as long as you kept the patient alive, being a high priority. But now I'm learning how important it is, the relationship that you have with not just the patient but with the family as well.
My guest is Dr. Peter Rhee, R-H-E-E. His book, Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities. When the trauma unit has an influx of patients, how do you decide who to treat first?
Well, that process is called triage, and that's what we teach all the way through our profession. It's a 7-year training program, and not just in mass casualty situations, but on a daily basis when you have 20, 30 people to take care of, you have to triage which ones are important.
If you have to choose between a drug dealer with a gunshot wound and a 7-year-old who has a gunshot wound, you still got to make a choice.
You have to make a choice. You know, the one thing is that I am not the judge and jury, and what you think has happened is not what's happened, and you have to just rely on physiology and the anatomy and figure out how to keep the patients alive.
So you don't necessarily want to know about your patients other than the medical condition they're in.
Yeah, I mean, that would be very quick and presumptuous to say that the story that they came in under was the social situation was actually true. You just focus on what happened to the patient and what it takes to keep the person alive.
Still, some of these people can be rather dangerous.
Some of them can be. Some of
You ever been threatened?
You get threatened. Your family can threaten you. And sometimes in a lot of trauma centers, we get patients from prisons. So, United States, we get prisons. When I was in the war, you were taking care of the enemy combatants as well. So the worry about what harm they can do to the providers are there.
And the enemy combatants didn't always appreciate the fact that you were helping to save their lives?
There may be some schizophrenics from prisons that really have totally lost with reality, but I would say uniformly, almost 100% of the time, when you're in that situation, you're the one person that they trust and let you do whatever you need to do to them.
You say working in an inner-city triage center isn't just heartbreaking. It can also be very frustrating.
Very frustrating as well, yes.
You see the same patients again and again.
Sometimes you'll see them 30 times, and they've had 30 operations. And it's a system where we don't really have a way of fixing their mental health problems.
Someone comes in with, and you are treating them, and you realize those scars are the scars from the last time you treated this person. Do you talk to them about that?
Well, you know, my first job was in Washington, D.C., in the inner city of Washington, D.C., and I remember a 17-year-old, he pulled the sheet away with all the blood on it, and the first thing you notice is that they got an incision and a scar that's very well healed from the last gunshot wound. You take a quick x-ray, and they have bullets, more bullets than they have holes. So you know that those bullets were from the previous operation. And, you know, I got a degree in master's in public health. I remember talking to a variety of people about how they feel that they can take care of their societal problems. But sometimes, you know, some of these people, You know, when you look at them, they're the kind of people that would come and slit your throat. So when you have to take care of some of these types of people that cannot be rehabilitated, it is a frustrating part of our job.
Did working in these kinds of hospital situations prepare you for being a battlefield surgeon?
Well, I think there's no doubt it did. How does one truly prepare themselves for battle?
But you're seeing people with bullet holes in them.
It's different kind of bullet holes, but it gets you somewhat ready for the real game. And that was the whole, you know, reason of why I did what I did, was so that one day I could perform in battle in a battlefield scenario.
One of the differences is in a hospital, you have all that equipment. You don't always have the same opportunities when you're in a battlefield.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's very hard to say these types of statements, but you got to understand that, you know, for people in my profession, in the military and so on, being in a battle zone in a war is what we live for. That's what we strive for. And to be in a situation like that when you don't have all the gear and you have to make life and death decision choices and decide what care they're going to get and not get, you know, those are the hard facts of life.
How did you wind up in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, interestingly, my job when I came back from Afghanistan was to set up a training facility, because there are Navy nurses who might have been in for 25 years but never seen a gunshot wound. Because if you remember, after the Vietnam War, we had relative peacetime for decades. So when this war came about, my job was to expose the people to some blood before they would go out there. You know, I can't have a corpsman who used to work in a clinic doing medical records all of a sudden make a mistake on an injured soldier, because my brother's a Marine Corps officer, and I don't want those kinds of mistakes being done on them. I don't want them to learn on their patients for the first time like they did in previous wars. So that was my job, is to train them. And then eventually I was able to get my turn out into the battlefield.
Where were you when you got the call that there'd been a shooting at a supermarket in Tucson?
Actually, that was my first day off in quite a while. It was a Saturday morning, so I was out for a run in Tucson, and I'm not a very good athlete or a jogger, but I was out there, and I had developed a system where all of the traumas would get mass texted out to our cell phones. And so I remember getting that text, looking down and saying, 10 gunshot wounds, heads up.
But you didn't know that one of the victims was Congresswoman Gabby Giffords.
That doesn't matter to me. It could be anybody. You know, to me, life is a life. Celebrities and VIPs are not that consequential when you're talking about the immediacy of the action.
When you saw the wound, did you assume that you'd be able to pull her through?
Yes, there was no doubt in my mind. You know, Randy Fries was a doctor that was in the resuscitation room when Gabrielle Giffords came in, and we were in contact all the time. So when I got there, I saw her. She was being wheeled into the operating room. And because she was alive already at that stage, and I could see the trajectory of the wound, I knew in my mind exactly what had happened. I knew that she was not going to die.
But that she would have brain damage.
Well, of course. I mean, this was not a tangential wound or a skiving wound. This was a severe wound.
Did all of the media attention make your job more difficult?
You know, you don't get prepared for that media attention, and I don't think anybody in my profession was prepared for the amount of media that case had gotten. So did it make it more difficult? It was a different set of challenges, and I never expected the media to be excited about the way we did things. But you never know, I guess, what the future lies.
Did they ask you about whether you supported gun control?
That topic came up. I don't necessarily support gun control or for or against. I think that is something that lawyers and society and legislation needs to do. But I think it is my job to let the American public know what problem that we have in our country.
Well, how many of the trauma patients you've treated over the years had been shot?
Well, I mean,
is that the majority?
No. In a city like Tucson, which is about a million and a half people that we cover, our penetrating trauma rate, which are gunshot wounds and stabbings versus car accidents and falls, is about 15%. When I was in Washington, D.C., that trauma center I worked at, the penetrating trauma rate was up to 40%. So it depends where you do work.
You've developed some innovative treatments or helped develop them for both civilians and soldiers. How does suspended animation work?
Well, that is something that how do you explain death? You know, I think what it does more than anything else is gets our eyes open to the idea that what we normally think of as being dead is not dead. I was able to develop a technique where I take all the blood out of a pig, large pig, man-sized pig, infuse them with very cold solutions with high amounts of potassium, and they are dead by all clinical means at that point, without a heart rate, without any brain activity, and they can stay that way for hours, and I can bring them back to life. So we are trying to see if there's a way that we can incorporate that in clinical medicine today.
The book Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities, written with the help of Gordon Dillow and published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.